But Harold Pinter, when he died, December 24th, you know, I really enjoyed his work as a playwright. I really thought he was just an logical successor to Beckett. But much more so, I so respected his politics. I really respected his courage. And he and Arthur Miller so many times took them on, et cetera, the powers that be on all sides. And you know, in his acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize, or Nobel Prize for Literature, which Amy Goodman brought quite a bit of this last week. But I remember with Naomi Klein, and she and I were talking about it. And Pinter actually used to have a lot of, kind of salons or meetings, whatever you want to call it, in his London flat with all kinds of progressives. And Naomi Klein's parents were lucky enough to be part of those, many of those. And so Pinter is such a huge influence. And she was actually saying that this part of the Nobel acceptance speech where, you know, if you remember that, you probably have seen it on YouTube, etc., because he was not able to go to Stockholm. He was much too ill. He had esophageal CA, and he was in the process of dying even then. And so, but he was not afraid in spirit. And so he was talking about the world, etc. And he, let's just pick this up, what he says. And this is Harold Pinter, part of his Nobel prize acceptance. He says, "But before I come back to the present, I would like to look at the recent past, by which I mean United States foreign policy since the end of the Second World War. I believe it is obligatory upon us to subject this period to at least some kind of even limited scrutiny, which is all the time we'll allow here. Everyone knows what happens in the Soviet Union and throughout Eastern Europe during the post-war period, the systematic brutality, the widespread atrocities, the ruthless suppression of independent thought. All this has been fully documented and verified. But my contention here is that the U.S. crimes in the same period have only been superficially recorded, let alone documented, let alone acknowledged, let alone recognized as crimes at all. I believe this must be addressed and that the truth has considerable bearing on where the world stands now. Although constrained to a certain extent by the existence of the Soviet Union, the United States' actions throughout the world made it clear that it had concluded it had carte blanche to do what it liked." And Naomi Klein said those words, and also all of her experience as a journalist all over, really started her thinking that she really had to write, to put this together as a history, so people really could have it. And the shock doctrine is resulted. And if you remember, we gave a whole program to the interview with her with shock doctrine. So let's just listen to some of this right now, because I think it is so apropos to what's happening right now. So Naomi Klein.
History, a fairy tale version of history. I think it's very positive that totalitarian communism has fallen. But there is such a thing as market fundamentalism, and that is what has been on the rise these past 35 years. And as you know, what I argue in the book is it didn't spread throughout the world through freedom and democracy. As we were told, it has spread on the backs of crises, shocks, and disasters.
Well, you know, Naomi, I remember when there were congressional hearings and that they were trying to find out what the heck was happening in Guatemala, et cetera. And I remember hearing this teacher, and she was testifying, and it so utterly horrified me when she talked about this. She didn't see them because they had a blindfold on her. But she said he was an American. He had an American accent. And I never really forgot it because she was being tortured pretty badly. And he got called out of the room, and apparently they left the door open, and he's answering the phone, and he's saying, "Oh, don't worry, honey. I'll pick them up from Little League after, you know, I'm done here." And, you know, that just blew my mind because I thought, what on earth are we doing down there and why?
You know, it's so important that you bring that up because I think, you know, we're having a debate about torture in this country, but we're acting as if everything began when Cheney and Bush entered the White House. And it's just not the case. There is a long and complex and painful history of U.S. involvement in torture. And, you know, the story that you're describing, there are dozens of stories like this of torture survivors testifying to being in a cell in Guatemala, El Salvador, Brazil, Uruguay, and there being an American sort of trainer or boss coming in and out of the room. It's usually the locals who administer the actual shocks, who do the dirty work. But there have been these training programs going on now, and places like the School of the Americas, which thankfully are still the subject of protests every year. These methods have been quietly spread, and the documents. And the testimonies do come through, but we somehow keep forgetting. We don't integrate these stories into a cohesive narrative. And that's really what I tried to do in the book, because I feel, you know, the book is about how we get exploited in moments of disorientation and shock. And one of the things that I've found, in part by living in Latin America and just studying this history, is that societies that know their history well, and they've really confronted the difficult parts of their past, are more oriented in those moments of shock. That memory, that collective memory, really is the best resistance to those who would take advantage of us in disorienting moments. This is, you know, our history is how we stay sane. It's how we know who and where we are. And state of shock, it is about losing that place. So that's why I'm trying to tell this alternative history, because I feel like we badly need a better story that explains how we got to where we are.
Oh, indeed we do. And you have put that story together. You know, one sees the connections, Tiananmen Square, the fall of Poland and Solidarity, and then what happened, the implosion of the former Soviet Union. And the connection even to Israel and its treatment of Palestinians now, it is there. And, you know, I one hardly knows where to start, because, you know, in a way, I think that the wealth of a nation and the value of a nation, I suppose, has always been fought over the very elite and the powerful, and not wanting to share this wealth with the vast majority of people. Kind of even in the founding of this country, really, with Jefferson and Hamilton and others. But let's kick it upstairs just a little bit. Hayek and Friedman, particularly at the University of Chicago, were so furious at the New Deal and the American welfare state. Was part of Friedman's philosophy a reaction to this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that it's the best way to understand the chapter of history we've been living for these past 35 years, and most acutely since Reagan, is as a revolt of the elites against the gains of regular people made since the New Deal, the Great Society. That, you know, and what's interesting about this is, you know, what I'm writing about is how crises are harnessed by the right. When I start the book with a quote from Milton Friedman saying, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change." And when that crisis occurs, the change that occurs depends on the ideas that are lying around. So really what he's spelling out is a strategy of intellectual disaster preparedness. When we think about preparing for a disaster of a hurricane, we think about stockpiling canned goods and water. Milton Friedman is talking about stockpiling ideas and keeping them ready for when the next crisis hits. Now, where this idea came from was actually watching how progressives had responded to the Great Depression, to the market crash of 1929, which, of course, was a massive crisis. And people were appalled by the brutality of the unregulated market, the suicides, the refugees, the Dust Bowl refugees, just the brutality of a system that had no safety net. And people wanted a different economic model. And that was the dream of the New Deal, was to, yes, have a market, but also have a net, also have a social safety net, also have redistribution, also have jobs, manage the economy and regulate it. And this model was actually enormously successful from the 30s through the 60s. And this was a period of actually a golden age for the American economy of rapid economic growth, the rise of the middle class. But it did cut in to the bank accounts of the elites in this country. It was not as profitable as the kind of economic model we have now, where you just have, you know, the employees of Goldman Sachs getting $16.5 billion in Christmas bonuses in 1 year. I mean, it was not this sort of oligarchic, super profitable model that we have to today. And I think what that tells you is that there was a revolt of the elites, and it was a successful revolt of the elites. When Reagan took office, CEOs earned 43 times more than their workers, and a couple years ago, they earned more than 400 times more than their workers. So I think that, this is the best way to understand the chapter of history that we've been living in, is really the elites of the country saying, we don't want so much of our money going to our workers, going to taxes that fund social programs, and really getting it back.
Yeah, like right now, actually, the fight over are they going to close loopholes with hedge funds. You know, when you watch right now and the handful of people who benefit so enormously, and yet the vast majority of people in this country would benefit quite a bit if those loopholes were closed. But not to digress.
And well, it's very, very relevant, actually.
Yeah. I mean, truly, I was reading this and you want to pull your hair out. And you know, and what do you think? A revolt of the elites? From Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, and she says, a large part of the appeal of the Chicago School of Economics was that at a time when radical left ideas about workers' powers were gaining ground around the world, it provided a way to defend the interests of owners that was just as radical and was infused with its own claim to idealism. The Marxists had their workers' utopia and the Chicagoans had their entrepreneurs' utopia, both claiming that if they got their way, perfection and balance would follow. The question, as always, was how to get to that wondrous place from there to here. The Marxists were clear, revolution, get rid of the current system, replace it with socialism. For the Chicagoans, the answer was not as straightforward. The United States was already a capitalist country, but as far as they were concerned, just barely. In the U.S. and all the supposedly capitalist economies, the Chicagoans saw interferences everywhere to make products more affordable, politicians fixed prices, to make workers less exploited. They kept minimum wages. To make sure everyone had access to education, they kept it in the hands of the state. These measures often seemed to help people. But Friedman and his colleagues were convinced, and they, quotes, proved it was their models, that they were actually doing untold harm to the equilibrium of the market and the ability of the various signals to communicate with each other. The mission of the Chicago School was thus one of purification, stripping the market of those interruptions so that it would be free. It could sing.
No.
Chicagoans did not see Marxism as their true enemy. The real source of the trouble was to be found in the ideas of the Keynesians in the United States, the Social Democrats in Europe, and the developmentalists in what was then the Third World. These were believers not in a utopia, but a mixed economy. To Chicago eyes, an ugly hodgepodge of capitalism for the manufacture and distribution of consumer goods, socialist and education, state ownership for essentials like water services, like the religious fundamentalist who has a grudging respect for fundamentalists of other faiths and avowed atheists, but disdains the casual believer. The Chicagoans declared war on these mix-and-matched economists. What they wanted was not a revolution exactly, but a capitalist reformation, a return to uncontaminated communism.